agora que eu não sinto nada mais e nada faz. Good evening and welcome to Amandla here on CQT 90.3 FM, your weekly African news and analysis show. So the Amandla team has decided to take what we would consider a well-deserved break. We're going to take the next few weeks off, but we've taken time to pull out what we consider some of the best of our programming over the last year or so. During these strange times of COVID, we nonetheless managed to pull together some interesting and relevant information. So Doug has kindly gone through our archives and pulled out pieces that we think bear rebroadcasting. So for the next 3 weeks, folks, we will be gone, and the faithful staff at CKUT will be making sure that these shows hit the airwaves every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Montreal time.
Gwen, what's up on your side?
Well, I mean, there's some very, very jubilant news out of Malawi this week. So we're going to be devoting a good part of the show to a very, very positive outcome after over a year of political upheaval, fraudulent elections, court challenges, and on and on. And Malawi held its elections this week, and the news is great. So we're going to be, well, Doug, you had a wonderful conversation with Nakumbira Mtali, who is, well, he featured large in your book. He was a huge dissident back in the Kamuzu Banda days with prison time and escape from Malawi, and he, you have a really wonderful conversation with him about that, and then you and I are going to kind of bat that back and forth a little bit.
Meaningless, unless people can see change. Freedom is meaningless, unless people can see change. Make it visible and tangible, we've been suffering. Today we must enjoy some liberty, that's just what we need. And this is what we want to see. Break the old shackles. This is what we want to see. Break the old shackles.
I have on Zoom from Mzuzu, Malawi, Makumbira Mtali. Max is a Canadian who has been doing the snowbird thing in Malawi, going there over the winters. He's of Malawian origin, and got caught by COVID. So he's still there waiting desperately to come home to Canada. Max, how are you?
I'm fine. And how are you?
We're doing well. We actually have summer now, so it reminds me a bit of Mzuzu.
I'm missing that. I'd like to be home.
Max, last Saturday night, you guys were glued to your TVs and radios. The whole country seemed to be wide awake. What was going on?
People had reached a stage where they were sort of getting frustrated with the process of counting, tallying up the numbers was taking too long. But when Justice Kifundo Kachari arrived and he said, well, I'm going to announce the election results, the whole country got very excited and he started shouting. He had to sort of slow down to start giving details of what they had gone through, how they looked at all the documents relating to the polling of during the elections. And when the numbers were announced, well, people were joyed and started dancing.
That by now was 11 at night, holy smokes.
Well, it was late at night, but somehow people went on the streets in the long Blantyre everywhere. In Muzuzu.
Even in little Kasungu, they had fireworks.
Yeah, that was something else. And actually, I think there were more celebrations in the center and in the north as compared to the south.
Okay.
Because for the first time, I think, the north, actually the second time, because during the time of Chakufa Kihana, Afford was the kingmaker. And this time around, the North has been the kingmaker as well. So MCP.
That's the Malawi Congress Party.
Yeah, and UTM.
The United Transformation Movement.
All the members of the Tose Alliance. All the members of Tose Alliance were involved in campaigning in all the areas, but more so in the north and central. Although Chakwera went to the south a couple of times, but the Chirima was the chap that crisscrossed the whole country, even to the tip of Malawi in the north and south. And he was driving alone.
Holy smokes.
He was the vice president at that time, which he is now as well. But he was driving alone. He was not using a government driver.
And no police escort.
No.
Wow. Yeah,
so this has been an exciting time.
Well, listen, let's so essentially the Malawi Electoral Commission gave Chakwera from the MCP with his running mate Saulos Chilima a majority of almost 60% versus 40% for the party of Peter Mutharika.
Yeah, that is the case. And those numbers for Chakwera and Chirima come from all parts of the country. So actually, while in the past, MCP was sort of closed out in the southern region, this time around, they did quite well. They made an inroad into the southern region, in areas like Mangochi, Blantyre, and Lower Shidi.
Excellent, excellent. So they do represent the nation from north to south.
Very much so.
How is that different from what was happening under Mutharika?
Yeah, and that is the case. But you see, MCP and the UTM, the message that they were communicating to the electorate was very appealing. They were talking of a country that belongs to everybody, a country that does not belong to one tribe, a country that does not depend on one section of the country. They want a country that is benefiting everybody. The resources should be used equitably in the north, the center, and the south. Nobody should be left behind. So that was a very appealing message to the electorate. And I think the other thing that he actually provided the impetus to people voting for the Tosse Alliance is the fact that the Chilima seemed to be a very good marketer. He marketed the Tosse Alliance very well. And actually, amongst all the people, the leaders of the parties, Chilima was the more appealing. And he has contributed a lot to MCP being elected into power.
Well, that's fantastic, and it's a positive change, and the people demonstrated their support of it by dancing all night on Saturday.
Yeah, and actually, the following day, they started having parties. They had in the long way, they killed a cow, and they were roasting meat and distributing to anybody who came and attended the celebration.
Tremendous.
And in the other places, the people on Sunday were dancing in the streets.
Well, listen, Max, this goes back a long way, but I think we should start with the election of May 2019 and the re-election, the rigged and corrupt re-election of Arthur Peter Mutharika, APM. Why were people so upset with that election?
Well, what happened in that election is that there were a lot of irregularities. The Malawi Electoral Commission did not follow the law. Like they allowed correction of the voting ballots with the Tippex, which is a fluid that you use to correct whatever you have written in ink on any paper. And there were boxes with ballots which had already been marked. So those added to the numbers for Mutharika. And some of them were not even signed. They were marked and not signed. But they were counted. This is because DPP was in control of the whole electoral process. And so when the results came indicating that Mutharika had been elected as president, the whole country was upset because they knew that he had no chance to win, but he won.
That the combined opposition should have beaten him out.
Yeah.
Now, why was he so disliked by the people?
Well, what has happened during the Mutharika period is that he has been running a criminal enterprise. They have been stealing from government funds. The contracts have been distributed to people from the Lome belt. And the almost all important government appointments and statutory bodies were occupied by people from the Lome belt. So actually, it's the Lome people who have been ruling this country up to now. And this enterprise has to be dismantled.
I see. Well, okay, so there was a lot of concern about the corruption and about the tribalism and about the way people were enriching themselves. Then came the court ruling that was so spectacular in February this year.
What happened is that in 2014, people were unhappy with the election of Mutharika.
That's his first term.
Yeah, that was his first term. But nobody had the courage to take Mutharika to court. And nobody had the courage to take the Malawi Electoral Commission to court. This time around, the vice president, who had been neglected by Mutharika, decided to establish his own political party. And when the elections were held in 2019, he knew that actually Mutharika had not won the elections. And he had the courage to go to court. He was joined by the Malawi Congress Party leadership. That's Lazarus Chakwera. And thank God, the Constitutional Court decided that they had a case that was viable. And in deciding the case, they decided against the Mutharika government. And then Mutharika and the Malawi Electoral Commission decided to appeal. When they appealed to the Supreme Court, what happened is that the Supreme Court affirmed the decision of the Constitutional Court. Now,
that took a lot of courage, Max, because even then, there were stories of attempted bribery and intimidation of these very judges in both levels.
Yeah, but I think the composition of the judges themselves possibly also played a role in having this case deliberated up to the end, because the judges that were involved in trying the case have been known in the country as always being honest judges and always sticking to the law. So there were attempts to bribe them, which failed. Actually, there is a case which is supposed to come back to the court tomorrow of one of the people that had been arrested for attempting to bribe the judges. So the judges, the type of judges of the people that were involved in the Constitutional Court and then the Supreme Court played a big role because they are fearless.
Can I also add that the army seemed to be relentless in its support of the Constitution and in determination not to be subverted?
It is a very interesting situation with the army and the police, because the Mutharika had been trying to sort of change the army to suit his own needs. He had removed the commander, the head of the army, and put in a chap from the Lomé belt. The same thing with the police. But strangely enough, the army, as well as the police, have been very professional. In fact, they played a big role in making sure that the elections were not there were no cases of vandalism or cases of people trying to disrupt the voting polling stations.
That to me also is remarkable, because the police after the election in 2019 acted very much like they were brutal against the protesters. It seems that after the court ruling of February 2020, they did a switch of approach.
No, actually, it's difficult to say that, because the army and the police left the alliance of DPP and DF do whatever they pleased. They never investigated any cases. Some people who had been killed, who were actually supposed to be supporters of MCP and the UTM, their cases are still hanging in the air. So the army and the police for some time behaved as if they were tools of the government. But I think everything changed when people started talking about the army and the police being misused by the party, the DPP party. And so when the new chairman of the Electoral Commission came in, brought in the army and the police to help in protecting the electoral process. And that sort of surprised the alliance of UDF and DPP. They didn't expect that.
There were cases of their party hoodlums being picked up in Kota and Salima, and whereas the police might not have done that in previous elections.
Before the election, they would not have done that. But the new chairman of MEC made sure that the army and the police were involved in the electoral process. So they became part of the tools that the chairman of the Electoral Commission used.
To enforce the Constitution.
Yeah.
Look, Max, we only have a few minutes left here. Can I get you to sort of reflect on where do you think things lie now? Where do you think things are going to go? With a new government, obviously there's a lot of hope and expectations. What could happen now, or what should happen?
It's a very delicate dance to that for the new government, because I think there's a lot of high expectations. They want change, and they want real change, not just talking about change. They want everybody in the country to be involved. They want those who ransacked the government resources to be taken to court and answer for it. They want a clean government. They want no corruption, which is a tall order. I don't know how they are going to meet that. And they don't want positions in government and in corporate institutions to be assigned to individuals because they belong to a particular tribe. They want everybody to be involved. There should be people in the civil service who are qualified, not brought in just because they belong to a tribe or a region or friends of the people in power. But the problem is the treasury has been ransacked. Where are they going to get the resources? That's a big question that the new government has to deal with.
Thank you, Max. This has been wonderful. Did you have any last thing you thought you might bring up?
I was saying that this is a proud moment for all Malawians. And the whole of Southern Africa, the whole of Africa, I think they have to learn lessons regarding the electoral process from Malawi, where there has been a free and fair election with no real cases of vandalism or killings or otherwise. So the country is jubilating about what has happened and looking forward with interest. And we hope that the new government is going to behave differently from the government that has just left the office. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Max.
So that was a wonderful piece sent to me in the wee hours of I don't know when, the day of the election. And that was Maimiko Saka, that's your nephew, Doug, who sent that to me through WhatsApp. And for our listeners, it's a little video showing a bunch of young people tearing down a sign that says Peter Mutharika Highway. And they're dancing and laughing and ripping that thing off with glee, which certainly reflected Maimiko's his optimism and jubilation. I remember he was so crushed at the outcome of what turned out to be the fraudulent elections. So discouraged, young man in his 20s, feeling like there was just absolutely no future under another Peter Mutharika government. And now, I mean, he's just walking on clouds and so unbelievably filled with optimism for the future.
Well, it's interesting. Actually, the election was the 23rd and there was a total silence and peace throughout the country. People were sitting on a knife's edge waiting for the results from the Malawi Electoral Commission. And so that came out Saturday night, 4 days later. They had 8 days to get those results out. They got it out, done in four. And they were scrupulous about their evaluation of all the ballots and the polling stations and the complaints from parties and went through them. And at 10 o'clock Saturday night, they announced the results after explaining the whole process. And people had been patient, quiet, waiting, just nothing happening. Mm-hmm. And those pictures you just saw, or you talked about rather, were Sunday morning celebration because the result had gone the right way.
Yeah,
danced in the streets, and they were very focused in their mm-hmm. in their dislike of that man.
Yeah, listen, that was a really interesting conversation with Makumbira. Really, very insightful, and I mean, you can just, you know, he's a pretty kind of hardened dissident who's had a very, very tough life politically and just existentially, having having combated the dictatorship of Kamuzu Banda, and as you said, has become fairly cynical about things, and yet here we listen to him and you don't hear the voice of a cynic at all.
No, and as you say, in the early 90s, he was a leader of the Malawi Action Committee here in North America, which grouped Malawians and a few friendly expats like me. We lobbied Parliament, lobbied Congress, and one of our members of the executive was the outgoing president, Arthur Peter Mutharika. Mm. And he was calling himself our legal counsel, and he was with us on, Nelly was on the executive with him. They did conference calls once or twice a week, and to have him go back home and craft an excellent model constitution for the new Republic of Malawi, and then turn around to be such a corrupt and returning the country to the days of the dictator and worse. Oh. And it was a total disappointment to so many of us, and an outrage. And that for a man who taught law at Washington University to turn out to be so bad. So for Max to be so ecstatic in his praise of the election, it says a lot.
Says a lot. It's kind of an astounding piece of irony that it was the Constitutional Court that ultimately quashed Peter Mutharika's fraudulent return to power, because the Constitutional Court stood up and said, no, these elections were fraudulent. We are going to, or at least they gave the parties the possibility to demonstrate that they were fraudulent, and that the Malawi Electoral Commission had dropped the ball in a serious way. And So that he had crafted the Constitution and then years later gets taken down by the Constitutional Court is very interesting.
Well, it's reminiscence of that old children's tale about the emperor has no clothes. Mm-hmm. He wrapped himself up in power so much that he just couldn't see the reality of going on, what was going on around him, while everybody else could see how bad it was.
Yeah.
And and so they paid him. They paid him dearly for it. And and it, still there was problems they were still buying votes in the southern region very, very thoroughly. We'll see quite a different record herein from that.
Actually, you just said something. Listening to Max's interview, and I'm sure I'm not alone, I'm sure there are other listeners who are not nearly as well-versed in Malawian politics as you are. Could you just explain a little bit the regional? Max talked about how the North was the kingmaker, and then there was the reference to the South and the Center. So just briefly, could you draw us a sketch of what that actually means?
Well, colonialism came to Malawi through the South, up the Shiri River and into the highlands of the southern region, and implanted itself there quite firmly. Tea plantations, tobacco estates, coffee, industrial development. Railway came in from the coast at Beira and Beira. And so development has been very, very much focused in the southern region. And the southern region has also absorbed, because of the fact that it's the only part of land in Malawi that's connected to Mozambique's west side and east side and so on. So there was a lot of transmigration, people going across borders. In those days, borders didn't matter anyway. And the Lomwe people in themselves came as migrants to Malawi. They weren't there when at least the colonialists arrived. They slowly came because of the Portuguese repression and the nature of underdevelopment and repression in the Portuguese colonies. So that many of them came and joined the peace of Malawi. That was British peace, of course. But it then became the industrial giant, and the population of the large city grew. Blantyre and Limbe, and then with the various sugar in the southern region, and in the lower Shiri, and the tea and everything else. So there was a lot more going on. Central region was more remote, and it didn't have nearly that kind of development. And Banda put his capital there in order to try and force development up into the central region. And of course, if you've been to Lilongwe, it's a sprawling savanna African city with a central core of elite buildings and then a huge surrounding of townships. And then finally, the northern region was really remote. Tanzania and Malawi didn't get on at the very beginning, so no cross-border stuff was going on because of the antagonism. And the northern folks had a few good schools. That's what the missionaries did bring up there. And so a lot of the northern folks had moved south and lived down there, prospered down there, become total citizens of the south, spoke the language and everything, but were much resented by tribalistic elements. So that's been a constant battle. And so the North called itself the Dead North. There was hardly any roads, hardly any development, hardly any infrastructure. And so they've always felt left out of the development process. And as he said, only once did they feel part of it. And that was when the first democratic elected government under Bekele Maluzi, they appointed the northern rep of the Ford party as a second vice president, even though it wasn't in the constitution, but it was to give him and the North a representation to ensure that the Malawi Congress Party couldn't come back from its, we'd hoped it was nailed down in its coffin, but apparently it's still alive. Mm-hmm. So that's it.
What did he mean when he said the North was the kingmaker this time around?
Well, this time, because the Constitutional Court, in addition to claiming the or denouncing or throwing out the election of May 2019 for being rigged and falsified, also said the constitution that they had set up in 1994 said that the president had to be elected by a 50 plus one vote majority. And they've managed to go by through all these past elections to adjust the first person, first past the post position. Mutharika got in the election of May 2019 and 2014 with less than 40% of the vote. And other parties carrying a balance that outweighed his votes. So this way, the North, going with the Tonse Alliance, threw their back into the Malawi Congress Party, despite what the Malawi Congress Party meant as wicked and evil politics back in the Kamuzu days, threw their weight into the Malawi Congress Party and the United Transformation Movement.
The balance of power.
And that just made them, mm-hmm. gave them that leverage. Mm. So he was also very clear about how they also won large sections of the South, Chikwawa and the Lakeshore are very, very significant areas. The Lakeshore was where major rebellion against the Malawi Congress Party occurred at 1964's independence, the Chipembere Uprising, Mangochi. So it was interesting that those two, and Blantyre being the big city, which is much more diverse and less susceptible to the tribalistic tendencies. You can't go to any township there and be a tribalist because everybody lives next door to each other. They marry each other. Okay. So that was the elements there.
Okay. Look, before we run out of time, I do have another question, and it's one of those, where are the people in this story? Because, you know, the way we're talking about it is really kind of, you know, the elites have brought about change. One group of elites formed an alliance and pushed out the other group of elites and all of this. I mean, is that the story or is this political change that we're seeing right now?
I think this is a very clear example of people power and anything people driving the elites. It's been totally the protests that erupted after the May 2019 elections were very popular. They were widespread, north to south. They were of a nature and a vigor, and of course there was violence and there was looting and there was burning, but the police were quite massively overwhelmed. They had no experience dealing with that kind of a mobilized population. The civil society organizations, they called it the civil society defenders, they came together as well, and outside of party politics, kept the demonstrations organized and running to the point that when Max says Chilima and Chikwera went to the Constitutional Court, by then they felt empowered because they knew they had people behind them. It's going to be very difficult to turn that huge ocean liner around. It's moving and people depend. The police aren't paid enough, so they do corruption on road checks. And how do you get that going? Where are you going to get the pay to give people decent working conditions and so on? But now that there is a commitment to a more honest government, if in fact there are any sorts of results, people will be very happy to go with tiny steps, but they must see change.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think we're out of time, Doug, but this is definitely something that we will continue to watch. And it's a very, very interesting and exciting story.
Well, and I, just as a last note, I think Max's comment about this has lessons for all of Africa.
Yeah.
Is very, very true.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Gwen.
Thanks, Doug.
Just a brief reminder that this is a rebroadcast from previous issues of Amandla. Stay tuned.
Rashid, welcome back to Amandla.
Thank you very much, Gwen. It's a pleasure to join Amandla once again.
It's been a long time.
Very, very long time. But I'm glad that you, the producers, and other people have sustained this program for, is it over 3 decades or so?
It's something like that. We don't need to dwell on that too long. But yes, it's a long-running show now.
Yeah.
And you were first got involved in Amandla. What year was it?
Oh, I think I just when I arrived in Montreal, was it 1992?
Wow.
Yeah. So when I was in McGill, I used to do this a little more frequently. Yeah.
Incredible. Okay, listen, let's dive in, Rashid. You're talking to me from New York, but you are originally from Sierra Leone. I just thought we're returning to the whole issue of COVID-19 and its impact in various ways on the continent. So just let's start, if we could just start by you drawing a portrait of what you know of what the impact of COVID has been to date on Sierra Leone.
Today on Sierra Leone, I think that so far the numbers are probably a little around 500 known cases of COVID, and about roughly maybe about 40 people or so have passed away. Again, these numbers are always very indicative. No country in the world has an accurate counting of either infected people or people who have passed away. The government in Sierra Leone has instituted a couple of lockdowns, very short lockdowns, and we are still sort of following the situation on the ground in Sierra Leone to see what its continued impact has been.
Well, as you know, I mean, the sort of the prescription of how best to quote unquote flatten the curve on the coronavirus is the regular hand washing, the social distancing of 2 meters, the trying to stay home and only go out for essential needs. And we know that that rolls itself out in very different ways in different places, and that in some places it simply is not possible. What does it look like in Sierra Leone with those measures?
Okay, so 2 things that were in Sierra Leone favor as it prepared for and responded to the epidemic. So first, there was social awareness of how you respond to a virus, both at state level and society level. So very quickly, before the first set of cases were detected, there was education about hand washing, about a certain degree of social distancing, and also very important about quarantining suspected cases of COVID-19. So before the last flights were actually suspended in Sierra Leone, the last group of passengers who came into the country were actually quarantined for a number of days. But as you know, that did not stop the virus from getting into Sierra Leone. The second thing that Sierra Leone has, and a lot of African country has this is the capacity to self-mobilize very quickly. And it comes out of 2 things. One, it comes out of the fact that there is a lot of land experience built into sensitizing and socially mobilizing people. the NGOs, one of the things that NGOs do a lot in Africa, and one of the things that they are very good at, is quote unquote sensitizing people. So there is already in many African countries and in Sierra Leone, specifically because of its past experiences, a lot of work around sensitization. So what the government did was to try to mobilize some of those existing organizations to embark on this round of sensitizing people about preventive measures around COVID.
Mm-hmm. So, but are you saying in that case that in fact people do have easy access to water and soap or some kind of a disinfectant to keep their hands clean? And do they have the kind of surface area that would allow them within their communities to maintain a social distance of 2 meters?
Okay, so this is where it gets complicated because there is one thing about the capacity to sensitize or to educate people about COVID. There is another thing about whether or not the environment lends itself to people closely and seriously following these particular measures. I think that this is where we have a problem in Sierra Leone, especially Freetown, and in many African capitals. So first, in many African capitals is that there are a lot of parts of the cities where the infrastructure is not simply good. That is, people have to go fetch water from taps or from water sources that are not immediately based in their homes or in their immediate residential area. So that does lead to a bit of crowding. Second, it's because of the nature and the structure of the economy, a lot of people live very precarious lives, much more so than in places like North America. It's not that you don't have people who live precarious lives here or who are in employment that are basically what we call hand-to-mouth employment. But in Sierra Leone and in many parts of Africa, the state does not have the capacity to support people who are in that particular position, to tie them through very long periods of lockdown or to support very strong messaging around social distancing. People have to go out on a daily basis to go make sure that they earn a living. And what that means is in particular parts of the city, especially people who are in lower socioeconomic brackets, it means that they are out and they are doing business, they're buying things, and they are in constant contact. So even when people mask, and there is not a whole lot of that going on in parts of Freetown, is that people are in constant interaction and circulation. What has been favorable about the picture here is not that the infection is not spreading. What has been favorable about the picture is that the rate of spread of the infection seems so far relatively slower than in other parts of the world. The mortality rate seems to be much lower than in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. How has the state responded to the fact that on the one hand, it's telling people to stay home, to quarantine, to isolate, and the fact that, as you pointed out, a lot of people can't afford that and they need to go out and sell their wares and make a living. Has the state been repressive, permissive?
Again, it's a mixed picture because at one particular level, and what the state did in Sierra Leone, and this is the only way it could have done it, was that you never had in Sierra Leone extended lockdowns. So the longest lockdown that you've had in Sierra Leone, I think, are lockdowns lasting for about 4 or 5 days. So you've never had this protracted lockdown. So that's one of the things that have made it bearable for people. The second is that during those particular lockdowns is that the state has really not treated people very well because the security officers, the law enforcement officers have sometimes been overzealous and have overstep what their mandate's in. So there have been people who have been punished for simply trying to get water or simply moving from one place to the other for a variety of reasons. So the pictures, some of the pictures that came out during the lockdown have not been good pictures. But also what has happened in Sierra Leone is the lockdown has been occurring in an environment where, in a political environment that is not a dynamic and a political environment that is doing very well. The government and the opposition are at loggerheads. And some of the government actions during the lockdown, before the lockdown, and even after the lockdown, has been frankly repressive. I mean, opposition leaders are now, some of them are now in jail. A couple of journalists have been arrested. So the political environment through which COVID is unfolding is not a very good political environment in Sierra Leone. And some of this has very little to do with COVID. COVID is just providing, in some cases, a cover for a government that is actually struggling to perform in the country.
Are there any other institutions in Sierra Leone that are playing an active role or mediating in these circumstances? I'm thinking trade unions, churches, mosques, any other players that are playing an important role during this period?
Insofar as social mobilization and development of community awareness around people's responses to COVID, the churches, the mosque, the civic organizations are playing a very important role. This was the point that I made earlier on about really having a historical memory or having an immediate memory of how you respond to pandemics or large-scale disease outbreaks, or really, in some particular case, humanitarian challenges like this. So you have that. You have organizations which have learned an experience. Politically, not many organizations. I know that the Sierra Leone Association of Journalists are unhappy about what's going on. The Sierra Leone Bar Association is unhappy about what's going on. Not so much from the trade union.
So you've referred to Sierra Leone's history in dealing with situations of epidemic or pandemic. So of course what you're referring to is Ebola. And this is something that sets Sierra Leone and a few other countries in Africa really apart from everybody else, whether it's in Africa or anywhere else in the world. So could you speak to that experience of Ebola, and perhaps how is that affecting people's attitudes towards COVID?
Okay, so as people are aware, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea are the three countries in Africa and the world really that have experienced the longest outbreak of Ebola. The Ebola epidemic in those three countries lasted for 2 years. Over 11,000 people in the three countries died. I think that well over maybe 40,000, if I'm not sure. I'm not sure about the numbers now, got infected. But for almost 2 years, these three countries were in a state of semi-lockdown or lockdown. So the kind of quarantining, social distancing, making sure that you have safe barriers were things that people had to live with for about 2 years. So there is a social consciousness around pandemics and how to respond to and how to break chain of transmission. A lot of that success of countering Ebola or stopping Ebola in these three countries were not only done because of international assistance, international solidarity and mobilization. It was also done at the level of people and community organizations becoming aware and responding and taking the right actions to break the chain of transmission. So immediately COVID once the COVID epidemic reached Sierra Leone, one of the things that was very interesting to see, almost seemingly, automatically or quickly, were people putting buckets with water and soap and disinfectants in public places, outside offices, outside places of worship. When you add schools on, also in schools. So that seemed like a very reflexive action that came from the land experience of Ebola. And quickly, people adopted masks. Although, again, just as in other parts of Africa, is people creatively responded to masking by making masking a fashion statement. Creatively, people design all kind of masks, so it was easier for people to absorb and to mask, especially in the initial stages. So that was one of the advantages, and this is why in those three countries and in many parts of Africa, I think initially the curve seemed flat, or it seemed as if the spread of the disease was slowed down. But the flip side of Ebola, the Ebola experience, and how you respond to COVID is this. COVID is not Ebola. COVID is not Ebola. And I say COVID is not Ebola because Ebola is a far much more lethal disease. The symptoms of Ebola, especially when people are symptomatic, is far much more evident and far much more frightful. And also, the other thing with Ebola is that Ebola is an affliction that spreads only when people are symptomatic. It's different from COVID. So, how is COVID different, and how is it probably affecting people's attitude in Sierra Leone and in many parts of Africa? So, one. Is that people can have symptoms of COVID, spread COVID, recover from COVID without being visibly sick. It's not that you didn't have that with Ebola, but you have that with COVID. Second, as has been demonstrated in other parts of the world, is COVID is a disease for which the mortality rate is higher in particular demographics and in particular groups of people than other groups of people. Ebola did not discriminate based on age or based on where people lived. So if you came into contact with somebody who was infected with Ebola, most likely you'd get Ebola. So with COVID is that all around the world, it's not that kids and young people don't get sick from Ebola, but they recover better from Ebola, from COVID. So this is what is different. So a lot of what's going on in places like Sierra Leone and in other parts of Africa, I think that people are making the kind of calculation that, for example, a country like Sweden has made, is that we might get infected with COVID. It might not be very visible. We might recover from COVID, and the signs might be like a bad flu, but if you have particular demographics, you'll probably get better. It's not, by the way, that COVID is not killing people. It's actually killing people, older people in Sierra Leone. We know a number of people in Sierra Leone who are older, who have gotten sick from COVID, and who have died from COVID. But the general sense is that it is not as lethal as Ebola. And as was said in Nigeria, and I'm sure with a number of people in Sierra Leone, in terms of their attitude, is look, we might survive COVID, we would not survive starvation.
Rashid, thank you so much. You've hit on a number of really important points. I really appreciate it. We'll continue to keep an eye on things, and maybe we'll touch base with you in a month or two and see how things are looking then.
Thank you very much, Gwen. Good to be with Amandla again.
Take care.
Thanks for joining us again on Amandla this week. We will be back next week, and please stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium.
Africa Unite! With the It Pays to Be Vaccinated contest, your COVID-19 vaccination could pay off big time. Every Friday in August, you could win $150,000 and two scholarships of $10,000. Plus, if you've had both shots September 3rd, there's a draw for 16 scholarships of $20,000 and a jackpot of $1 million. Register now for the It Pays to Be Vaccinated contest at quebec.ca/vaccination contest. The sooner you're vaccinated, the faster you can take part. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
It takes a good dose of courage and perseverance to get through a pandemic.
True, but it also takes a good dose of patience, resilience, confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.